John Knowles is a comedian based in Australia, but he was born and raised in Canada. John was on Conversations last week talking about this guy.
John, you never could fight, could you? Your sister's tougher than you. Better horseman, too. Now, she's a class act.
That's Chuck Knowles, John's dad. Chuck was a Canadian cowboy, for a while, anyway. And then he was a cowboy entrepreneur. He made several fortunes, and he lost all of them. Chuck married an Australian woman, June, and they had kids. And John grew up in the shadow of his charismatic father. But John wasn't really the rugged, hard-living outdoorsman his father wanted him to be. John was bookish, nerdy, and he wore glasses. And so his father would say things like this to him.
You're a straight shooter, John, and that makes me proud. You're not the best, but there's none better. Come to think of it, there is someone else now. He died.
I guess it's true we both had big expectations that neither of us could live up to.
You haven't had the highs and lows of my adventures, but you're living your own dreams, and you make people laugh. And I expect that's tougher than riding any bronc.
In our first conversation, John told the story of his father's adventure with two friends and a suitcase full of cash. And if you want to hear that story of Chuck Knowles and the millionaire kids, it's available as a podcast. But there's another story here. John's family, particularly his mum, had to go along with Chuck for the wild ride through the disastrous investments. Chuck's bold ambition to beat McDonald's at their own game with a chain of hot dog fast food joints, with restaurants actually shaped like a hot dog. They went from riches to riches and then rags again until it was all too much, and John and his mum had to escape to Australia. John Knowles is putting together a live show about his life with his cowboy dad, Chuck, called Storyteller. Welcome back, John.
My pleasure.
So, John, there's your dad, Chuck, the ex-cowboy, and there's your mum, June, who was born in Australia. How did they meet?
My mum was born in Petersham, 27 Petersham Road. She grew up with just her father and a sister because the mum died quite early. I think she was like 9 when her mum died. He had been all around the world, and he used to tell her stories about going to far-off places. And so she wanted to see the world. And her friends, when they were 21, decided to find husbands overseas. So 4 of them saved their money and told people we're going overseas to find husbands. And there's a clipping over there somewhere of my mom and her 4 gorgeous friends on the gangplank of the Orana. And the Sydney Morning Herald is saying, you know, Aussie beauties go overseas for husbands. And 3 of the 4 did find husbands.
I'm seeing photos of your mother here from the 1960s. And she's incredibly beautiful. Like knockout beautiful, like belongs on the set of Mad Men, beautiful. Was she a model of some kind?
She was a model. She used to work with June Dally Watkins when she was here, and she was an Arthur Murray dancer and a model. And so when she went overseas, she got a modeling agent in Montreal and did a lot of modeling over there. And that's actually where she met my dad. My mom met him one night and then was leaving the next day because she was moving to New York because she'd got a job with the Australian consulate. She was going to be like their meet and greet gal at the UN. And while she was down there, he flew down one weekend on a whim to take her on a date. And she thought, oh, that's pretty wild. So they went on a date in New York and then he flew back to Montreal. And then the next day when she got to her apartment, it was filled with roses. Like filled, like all the rooms were filled.
Your dad was that guy.
He was that guy.
That charming rogue.
Yeah, charming rogue. That's right. Warning bells left and right, but she was in. She thought, oh, you know, what a charmer. And he leads this exciting life. And
every day will be like this from now on.
That's right. And he comes from a very well-to-do family in Montreal. And her father was working class. So this was all very exciting to her.
So they got married.
They got married and
had kids.
Yeah.
And where are you in the lineup, John?
I'm second. So there was my sister first, Wendy. And then there was a birth in between mine and my sister's that was, it was a very awful, awkward pregnancy. The baby was deformed and barely alive and should have been terminated way earlier, but they wouldn't do that in Catholic Montreal. If it had a heartbeat, you had to have it naturally. And my mom's body was poisoned by it, and she was bloated and enormous. And when the baby was born, they wouldn't even show it to her. They got sent off to Mount Sinai or somewhere for testing or something. And she almost didn't want to have kids after that because of it. Her doctor said, well, you don't have any more if you don't want to, type thing, because it was a very traumatic thing. But then she fell pregnant again with me.
And when were you born?
I was born at the moment pretty well that John F. Kennedy was assassinated. My dad liked to say the world suffered two blows that day.
November 1963.
You were born November 22.
Yeah. November 22. Almost at that moment that Kennedy
just
was assassinated?
Just about. The folklore is that Mum was having me when the shooting took place. And because of her last birth, her doctor was anticipating another difficult one. So my mom had been given a shot of heroin, which is common in Canada. And so my mom was flying on heroin when the nurse burst in with news from Dallas and yelled, Kennedy's been shot. And apparently my mom said, whoopee, shots for everyone. So they, of course, named me John.
After the president.
But my dad wanted me to be little Chuck, right? So my mom didn't want Chuck and Chuck too. So she said, well, we can call him Charles. So my real name is Charles John Knowles.
So you came into the world and in these very inauspicious circumstances. Yeah, yeah. You were born into this family in Montreal. There's your dad, Chuck, the kind of sad ex-cowboy, but nonetheless one of the good families, one of the wealthy, most respectable families in Montreal. How was your grandfather? What was he like with you and your siblings?
He was an odd character. He was very brusque and stern. He never warmed to me or my little brother. In fact, I don't think he liked any of the grandsons. And because my sister was the first of his grandkids, he adored her, doted on her. And so my view of my grandfather and my sister's view of the grandfather are completely different. She thinks he was wonderful, and she used to ask for things, and he'd just go and do it. He'd pick her up, and she'd be about four, and he'd take her to his men's club, where you know, you had to be a bastion of industry or something to even get in. And she tells this one story of him taking her there, and he has his own table because he's president of the Chartered Accountant Society. And the waiter comes and says, and what would you like, miss? And she says, pancakes. And the waiter said, I'm sorry, this club, we don't serve pancakes. And Noel says, if my granddaughter wants pancakes, she'll have pancakes. And the man runs off. And 10 minutes later, there was a stack. Not like three. There was eight. Eight pancakes with strawberry sauce and ice cream and everything. She said, it was terrible because I thought I had to eat it all. And so she made herself completely sick. She said, I only finished four and I had to apologize. And I didn't know that I didn't have to finish it all.
So there's this kind of controlling paterfamilias, the grandfather. How did your mum, from working class Petersham, now living in Montreal, amongst Montreal high society, did she chafe under your grandfather at all? Yeah.
Yes. She and Noel did not get along at all. He didn't listen to, he didn't like kids except for Wendy, and he didn't listen to anyone else's advice. So, for instance, I remember Mum telling me a story of when we went over there for Sunday dinner, and they set up this beautiful table, and in the center of the table, they put the big chocolate cake that they were going to have for dessert. Now, here's parenting 101. You've got a one-year-old, a four-year-old, and a nine-year-old, and they're going to sit there and have the mains before they go near that chocolate cake. And guess what the main was?
What was the main?
Noel's favorite. Cold sliced tongue. And we all got a serve of that. A
slice of tongue on our plate. And my mom said, stupid, I looked at, said Johnny looked at the tongue, and he looked at the cake, and out his hand went, and I just grabbed a big hunk of cake and ate it. Well, Noel went ballistic and started saying, oh, you know, these kids are, you know, they're not trained well, whatever he said. And my mum flew into a rage at him and said, we're not coming back to this house. And they didn't talk for a year.
Meanwhile, your dad had given away being a cowboy and become a businessman. And you'd said how he'd gone into business with this thing called a Silvermatic, a dry cleaning machine. And he went to this dry cleaning convention one day. What happened there at this convention?
Well, he went down to Des Moines, Iowa, for this convention, he said. And while he was down, and this is another thing he didn't tell me for years and years and years. He said, while I was down there, I met a girl. She was in the American military, and she was at the convention as part of her job to clean the uniforms of the military. And we had a little tryst. And apparently there's a sister of yours somewhere.
When did you find this out?
I would have been about 30-ish, something like that. My mom suspected something because my dad forbade her to ever touch or open his mail. She's certain he was paying for the kid. She knew money was disappearing at regular intervals. And then she assumes that the woman got married and the payment stopped.
The dry cleaning business went bad. What happened then after you went broke?
When Silvermatic and the dry cleaning business went belly up, my grandfather lost a lot of money and a lot of his kudos and respect. And he blamed Charles, Chuck, for wanting to make it into this Silvermatic wonder business instead of just plodding along. And he's probably right in a way. That was, you know, my dad was never going to sit there and just dry clean shirts all his life. But Noel was a terrible businessman too, and an even worse people person. So he probably spoiled it himself. And the two got into a horrendous fight. And my dad said, I'm leaving. And he packed the kids in a car and we drove to Nova Scotia, which is out on the east coast of Canada.
Man, so that's like leaving, I don't know, Sydney for out of Tasmania or somewhere like that, isn't it?
It is. Very similar to that.
Yeah. So what about your grandfather, though? He'd been this kind of respectable businessman, a pillar of high society, and he'd gone broke. How did that affect his standing and his state of mind going broke?
He really suffered. His mental health suffered in a bad way. He started making rash decisions to try and get his money back in different ways, and they failed too. They had to sell their big house. They had to sell everything. They ended up in a little tiny apartment. And he retreated. I think in the end, he died penniless.
So your dad was broke. And so you, your brothers and sisters, and your mum and dad packed up, left Montreal for Nova Scotia. Do you remember that, leaving?
I do. Yeah. I remember because we had a beautiful house with beautiful neighbors and all my friends were on the one street. And when we left, my dad had to buy a station wagon. He bought this big purple Buick estate wagon to fit stuff in it so we could go. And my mom was trying to hide the fact that it was really upsetting her. And on the way there, it happened to land on her birthday. And we were at a hotel. And I was just, I couldn't figure out why she wasn't happy. It was her birthday. She should be so happy. And we'd made her this gift. And we thought, here's a great idea. Mum's not that happy. So let's do a fun game so she can find her present. And so we got the longest roll of string and we wound it around everything in this hotel room and down the hall. And we said, Mum, all you have to do is wind it up to find your present. I know it took her like an hour and a half, 2 hours to wind this thing up. And at the end was like something the three little kids had made that said, happy birthday, Mom. We just couldn't believe she wasn't ecstatic about this.
Well, she'd grown up in one of Sydney's poorest suburbs and found her way out to high society and to live the lives of what was something like the super rich.
Yeah.
And here she was sliding back down to poverty again.
That's right. When they arrived, they didn't have anywhere to go. Dad heard that there was an apartment being built, a place called 79 Lakecrest Drive, and it wasn't housing commission, but it was the next step up, might as well be. And my dad took the job as the guy who shows the apartment, the one that's built, which is ours, to prospective people so they can say, yes, I'll take one. And so as they're being built,
they move in. I mean, I thought it was great because we were the second family in this apartment building that was going to have three floors of 26 apartments full of kids. It was magic. During the winter, we arrived there in winter, you could go to your friends' houses in your pajamas. It was great.
So your dad is the guy who's essentially the concierge of this showcase apartment. What was your mother's role around this apartment block?
Well, it's funny you should ask it because when my mom passed away a couple of years ago, we got a lot of letters and things from kids who were from that apartment building. People we knew, but really maybe didn't know that well, but we knew they were kids when we were kids. And it turns out that my mom was like the halfway house street mom who, if you had trouble because you're getting beat up by your dad or whatever, you stayed at our place. Like, I just thought people were just staying over, right? Maybe they were crying, but whatever. We got another guest. And we always had people staying over. Like, she was the one who, if you got into trouble, she took you for an abortion. Or she did whatever. Because she was that type of person who was always on the lookout for the kid who, you know, was in trouble and who needed a friend. And we got these beautiful letters from people.
How different was she from your dad, the man she married?
Immensely different. The only thing I think that connects them is their love of excitement. They both loved limelight and a party and being vivacious and whatnot. Apart from that, Mom wanted to hug people till they were, you know, she was demonstratively sloppy hugs, you know, and she wanted little Fred Astaire's where Dad wanted little John Wayne's.
You know. Right, but your dad wasn't affectionate at all, as you said.
No. I mean, later in life, my mom did own up. Our intimate life was dreadful, John, between you and what? We made love 6 times and there were 4 pregnancies. You know that?
And that was it. That's weird talking to people about their parents' sex life.
I know. It's
but,
very
but,
right.
But that was it for the rest of the marriage then?
Yeah. Someone used to say that my dad put my mom under a pedestal. And I think that was apt because he liked how beautiful she was and great at parties and a showpiece on her arm and all that, but she was quite feisty, and so when things were bad she had to just create jobs out of nothing to so that we could eat that week.
How did your mum make ends meet when times were really tough?
My mum was very creative at handicrafts, and she was a painter and she was great with flowers. She's a florist, and she came up with this idea one day to get artificial flowers and hand paint them so they'd be the color that she wanted and the look that she wanted, and then put them on these little sticks and wind a piece of wire around them and then arrange them in styrofoam and sell them to people to match the colors of their decor. So this thing that she created, she walked in, she remembers telling me, I walked into this shop called the Seven Seas Gift Shop in this crappy little mall in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia. She said, would you put this in your window with some sort of price tag on it? And if it sells, can I have half the money? And the guy was like, oh God, all right. And they got on his people. So he said, of course, I'll put it in the window. Well, it sold an hour later. He said, can I have another one? So she made another one and it sold. And suddenly she was providing a dozen of these a week, and he'd put the price up to, like, I remember they're like $35-40, which was a lot of money back then. And she said, some weeks if I didn't sell one, we didn't eat, but they were selling so well that we suddenly had to move out of the big room so that could become her little paint room. And, you know, I must have put on a couple hundred thousand of those wires onto the sticks in my life. That was my day job.
And did your dad mind? Did he like the fact your mum was making money?
And he was very happy the fact that she was able to pay for some bills when he couldn't. I mean, there were times when, one time we were living in this house up on this hill in a place called Nantucket, and we had like big pillars on the front of the house, really nice house. And Dad couldn't afford the electricity. So for 2 months, we were in that house with candles and a Coleman stove, you know, a camp stove, sitting on our beautiful range in the kitchen. And we were pretending, we had to pretend. And so we'd put candles near the windows at night and pretend that we had power. And then finally Dad got some money and we got the power turned back on.
When did things start to improve financially for your family?
He got in with some doctors, and they were well-to-do doctors, and he convinced them Dartmouth needs a shopping mall. It's the latest thing. This was like 1972 or whatever it was. And they bought this piece of land despite protests from people in the area who didn't want a mall there because it used to be a park. They put up Woodlawn Mall. And it was quite successful for a while. I worked in at least 8 of the shops there. You know, the Dud Hut sold the best jeans.
The Dud Hut?
Yes, the Dud Hut. The Candy Bowl, I worked there. Yes, and the Woodlawn Fitness Center, which my mom ran, because it was like it was more of a beauty parlor than a fitness center, but, you know, she taught them June Daly Watkins stuff while they went on those tummy trimmer things that do nothing, you know.
So what did this mean for your life once suddenly there's money coming in because your dad now is part owner or...
Well, it was great. We moved from Lakecrest Apartments, which was... I was really sad to go because I really liked the apartments and I knew so many people there. And when we moved up to the, you know, moving on up to the east side, well, this, they were a little bit snobby and a bit, you know, whatever. But eventually, you know, I liked it.
Tell me about how your father decided to go into the restaurant business after that.
Well, around that time, McDonald's and Dairy Queen had moved into Main Street, Dartmouth, and they were making a matzah. And Dad and his buddies were talking about, well, we should put a McDonald's on the parking lot of Woodlawn Mall. And Dad looked into it, and he found that the franchise fees were quite high for a McDonald's. And so he said, I think we're better off starting our own restaurant and putting it against McDonald's, and then we'll own all the rights. So they needed a product that was different, and they needed a building that was different because all these buildings had to be unique. So one of their friends, a guy named Gordy Minogue, was a chef. And they said, Gordy, we need a product. We need a food product that will sell. And he said, well, look, here's the story. I was on the Bar Harbor to Boston ferry once, and we lost all of the food overboard in this big storm. And we still had another 8 hours to go. And all that was left was these hot dogs, these big, extravagant hot dogs. And I had to figure out what to do with them. So I came up with a hot dog, which was wrapped in bacon and had melted cheese and onions on the bottom and relish and whatnot. And he said, and I called it the Swanky Frankie. And my dad went, that's it. That's the name of Ka-ching! Our new restaurant. We'll be Swanky Frankies, right? So Swanky Frankies came into existence, and Dad said, well, we're not going to be just any building. We're going to have a building that is unique and is shaped like a hot dog. So at a huge expense, got rounded panes of glass so you could sit in the bun, the sides of the bun. And you walked up these big stairs into the front, which was the end of the dog. So you walked into these brown doors and into the hot dog. And I worked there. I worked for Swanky Frankies. I can still cut onions faster than anyone you know.
That sounds pretty cool.
It was. I loved it. The problem was, you know, 26 varieties of hot dogs. How many people love hot dogs? You like a hot dog once in a while, right? So it went for about a year, and then it just slowly, it started to lose money. And Dad thought, well, no, it's not that. It's that we need to consolidate. We need another one, but not another Swanky Frankies. We've learned our lesson. We're not going to get another non-existing franchise. We're going to get the fastest growing fast food franchise in America.
And what was that?
Arthur Treacher's Fish and Chips.
I've never heard of that.
There's only 3 left. At one point, there were 90.
Arthur Treacher's Fish and Chips.
Yeah. Arthur Treacher's that guy. You may know him. He was the quintessential English butler. He's Jeeves, right? So he was the face of fish and chips wrapped in, you know, newspaper.
He was the Colonel Sanders of...
He was the Colonel Sanders, and he was on our logo, right? So we bought another building, put it right beside McDonald's, an incredible downtown spot on Main Street. And again, they spent a fortune on this building, which had to look like an English house in the middle of Nova Scotia. And to great fanfare, we opened up Arthur Treacher's Fish and Chips, and it went well for quite a while because it was, you know, quality food being sent from America. And then it sort of tailed off when everyone had one go at it or two. And then I realized later that this is Nova Scotia. This is we're like, you know, a few miles off the Grand Banks of Newfoundland.
With the best fish in the world is
best, around. Freshest cod you can get. And we're serving deep fried triangles of frozen North Atlantic whitefish, as we had to call it, because cod could have worms. So we weren't even serving a fish they'd ever heard of, and it was frozen and battered. And you could get the best fish next door at John's Fish and Chips.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio. On air, online, and on your mobile.
Comedian John Knowles returns to Conversations today with the story of how his Australian mum, June, met his cowboy dad, Chuck, in Canada. How they started a family and stayed with him as he made and lost several fortunes, going from Montreal high society to something like a housing commission flat in Nova Scotia, to investing in an exciting new chain of hot dog fast food joints called Swanky Frankies. Never heard of Swanky Frankies? Well, that's because it never took off. So you went broke.
We went broke.
And was this catastrophic broke?
This was huge broke. It meant that dad's relationships with his investors and essentially his friends ended. And the pressure on the marriage was incredible because dad started drinking a lot. He'd just be sitting in the front room listening to Johnny Cash with a bottle of booze next to him and lamenting how these should have worked. It was the right idea. That was around when I was about 16.
Your 16th birthday, John. Tell me how that unfolded.
I remember it was my birthday and I was having my friend Ian over. I've changed the name to Ian because I don't want to say who it really was in case he ever hears.
We'll call him Ian then.
Call him Ian. He and I were going to have a dinner together. Mum wasn't there. And my dad said, Johnny, got a present for you. Well, I was thinking maybe it's another bow tie. He said, nah, two hookers, home delivered. I thought he was joking. And then the door opened and in walked a cute, tarty-looking girl named Krista and a very tall one named Charlene. I remember their names. Yeah. And my dad looked over at me and he said, Johnny, take your pick.
What did you do then? What did you think?
Of course, I said to him, does Mom know? He said, Johnny, get her in there. Well, they sat down on the couch and I started saying, would you like a cup of tea? And
were you embarrassed?
Oh, yeah. And I'm stalling. And my dad, he's like, he's looking at me. He doesn't understand it. He's like, get her in there. And suddenly I see Ian's hand go up and he goes, to, Mr. Knowles, if they're already paid for. So Ian goes into my room and becomes a man on my birthday.
On your bed.
On my Star Wars sheets. That's right. And so I'm in the lounge room, and I'm talking to Krista. She's the little one. And we're discussing university courses that I might take. And my dad, he is flipping out. He's going, get her in there. Get in your younger brother's room. Get her in there. And I'm going, no, in the end, the truth of the matter is that I chickened out. And the next day, I got grounded.
You got grounded because you wouldn't have sex with a prostitute in the family home.
What? Who hasn't been grounded for a similar crime?
This is really funny now. But at the time, it must have been mortifying or something. I don't know. At the time, what did you make of all that?
I can remember at the time, the bed pounding against the wall in the room that Ian was in, and my poster of Ken Dryden, my favorite goalie, fell off the wall. And that's the moment I made my decision. I'm not going in there.
Was Ian grateful afterwards?
Very. Very. He came to my next birthday.
As you said, at this time, the family business went badly broke, and this put your parents' marriage under a great strain. What happened?
Well, my mother and my father finally called it quits. My mum had been seeing a lawyer a divorce lawyer and trying to figure out how she could extricate herself from the marriage, because there were a lot of deals still on the go, like money owing to various people and whatnot. And she was worried, and the lawyer was worried, that if Dad up and left, she'd countersigned all these crazy projects that he wanted to do. One thing that they happened to have countersigned was this car, this new car we'd bought. And so the lawyer said, well, you should hide that car, and because we're going to try and get Chuck to leave the house, but he's going to take the car because, you know, he feels it's his. So on the night that he was delivered the papers that he had to leave from the cops, they also gave him a bus ticket to Toronto, and he went down to get in the car, and I had taken it, and it was actually at Ian's house. And I had to stay over at Ian's house with the car, and Mum had to stay at a friend's house. And then the next morning, Dad and a suitcase were gone, and he did take the bus and went to Toronto.
And that's how your parents' marriage ended.
Yeah. But my mum wanted to come back to Australia at that point. She didn't. She was like over Canada. So yeah, she decided to work her way here on a container ship, because that's what my mum was like. There's a line called the Columbus Line, Hamburg Sud. You might see their things around town. And they had a dozen ships that go around the world, container ships. And she went and spoke to the captain of the ship that was in town and said, can I put some furniture in the hold and I'll work my way to Australia? And I've got my 15-year-old son and he'll help too. And they went for it. So that's how she got back.
You stayed behind though, didn't you?
I stayed behind because that previous summer I decided to go out to Toronto and try to go to acting school.
And that's where you met up with your dad again.
Yeah, it was a very weird feeling because I hadn't seen him and I didn't know if he was still angry for like betraying him or whatever. And so I called him from a friend's house saying, I'm in town. I've got into Ryerson Acting School. And, you know, I thought he'd be like, yeah, punsy actors or something like that. But he wasn't. He was quite impressed. He said, great. Well, we've got to get you a place downtown near the uni so you can be close by. And he said, well, I'll take an apartment and we'll live together.
So you ended up sharing this apartment with your dad. How big was this apartment, though?
It was one room with a toilet and a little kitchenette thing. There was nowhere that I couldn't see my dad's big toe. Like, no matter when I went into a corner and tried to make it so I couldn't see him. We only had one bed. Well, he didn't have a bed. We had a couch that pulled out to become a bed, which he would sleep on. And then I would take the two cushions from the couch, put them on the floor, push them together, and that was my bed for a year and 18 months.
How supportive was he of the idea of you becoming a performer?
I like to think that he was very supportive. And, you know, once he got that I was serious about it, I think he came good to the idea that, okay, well, if Johnny thinks he can do it, then Johnny is going to get some help and I'm going to support him. So I'd be doing these horrible sort of plays and things in the middle of nowhere. At one point I was playing in this musical reviewy thing that was just awful in a club in the middle of nowhere, and it was full of punks. And there in the front is my dad sitting in his suit and in his cowboy boots and his hat with a beer. And he's got his thumbs up. Way to go, Johnny. Sounds good. He hated it, but he wouldn't miss it. He used to go to this place called Jingles, which was a bar. And he'd go there late at night because he liked it because all the CBC presenters and you know, actors and stuff would go there. And so he'd be there and, 12:30 in the morning, I'd get a phone call. Johnny, I'm with Michael Sarrazin. He wants to meet you. Get some clothes on and get down here. You know, like, so he'd have chatted up some famous star or whatever, and I'd go down there and he'd introduce me. Like, he thought that he was helping, and it was fun. It was weird, but it was fun, you know.
So there's your dad. He's taken you on this roller coaster ride all your life, constantly telling you how he wants you to be different and do this and do that and all these things. But all I get from this is how much he loved you, actually. That's what I hear in this, is how much he loved you. Couldn't hug you, but still, yeah, loved you.
Yeah. Well, he used to write me these letters. And it only ever had two sentences. The letter would be, Dear John, I'm working on the oil rigs, or I'm doing whatever I'm doing. I'm selling Persian carpets now in Milwaukee. I hope you're doing well in the plays and that you have a job. Much love, Dad.
And there's usually a clipping. And the clipping would usually be something he thought would inspire me. and they're invariably not inspiring, but it was inspiring that he was looking through papers with me in mind.
You said he wasn't affectionate, physically affectionate, and wasn't a hugger, but are you a hugger with your kids?
Oh, yeah. I'm a big hugger. I think I've tried to do the things that I didn't think he was able to do. With my kids, you know, I'm always kissing them goodnight and big hugs and telling stories and making sure that they know I'm here all the time for them. And so is my wife, Renelle. But I think more so, I think I'm overcompensating because I didn't get that.
So your mum had come back to Australia, working her way back on a ship. How did you get out of here?
Well, about a year later, I got thrown out of Ryerson Acting School because I was doing comedy at Yuck Yucks, and that's against their policy. And so I thought, well, I'll come to Australia for the first time. So I went out back to Nova Scotia, and a boat came in, a container ship, and I spoke to the captain, and he said, okay, I'd like the cut of your jib type thing, and you're on. They used to call them workaways. So you can have one passage around the world if you work, but you have to give them $400 cash, which they hold, and they can throw you off the boat at any time if you're not working hard enough. Because it was really hard work. You're up at 5 in the morning and you work till 5 at night. Hard, you know, labory type stuff. So I walked into the mess room where we sit and eat our things, and I looked over and I saw some familiar in the corner, and I went over and I picked up this handicraft, this thing that I was so familiar with, and I turned it over and it said Flowers by June.
And oh, it was one of your mother's flower things.
Somehow, some freakish coincidence, I ended up on the same boat in the same cabin as my mom and my brother had been on a year previously, and I was holding her flower piece that she had thought would brighten up the mess of this ship. So I thought, I took it as a sign that I was supposed to come, and it cheered me up to no end.
Did your mum make the right decision leaving your father, do you think?
I think she had to, for her own sanity and for, you know, he was not in a good place. It took him a couple of years of building himself back up till he was a good person again. He was messed up for a while. But yeah, I think she did. When she came back to Australia, she got here with nothing. And ever the one who wanted to mingle with socialites and do the, you know, the parties and things, she found the cheapest place in Mossman to rent. And she had, you know, cardboard boxes with elaborate doilies over them so that no one would know that it wasn't furniture. And she lived like that for a year with nothing until she could get a job. And she ended up working at David Jones and was quite a social person up there. I remember she came on one time and she said, I've met the most wonderful woman. I said, oh yeah, who was it? She goes, Jana Wendit. I said, oh yeah. You mean Jana Wendit? I guess so, she said. Oblivious to anyone's station in life if they were nice.
Did she remarry?
And she never actually married, but she met a wonderful guy, a guy named John Knutson, who was the antithesis of my father. He was a Catholic accountant, very straight,
reliable,
everything Dad wasn't and everything my mum needed at that time. And they became very happy and they were an item and right to her death.
So you left Canada behind and arrived in Australia, having worked your way over on the same ship your mum was on.
Yeah.
What did you think once you got to Australia?
I was ready for an adventure because I had my heart set on graduating as an actor. And when that fell through and I got kicked out, I was like, that's it. I can make it on my own. I'll go to Australia and do something there. So I was really happy to be here.
So you arrived in Australia. Tell me how you met your wife, Renelle.
I showed up at this party. It had already been a big day, really. I'd finished a film that morning, and I had running down the front of my face was a tattoo of a ladder as part of this character I was playing. And after the film, I'd gone to my soccer grand final, which we'd won, and had a lot of drinks. So I showed up at this party. Really, I was not really at my best.
Half cut with a tattoo of a ladder on your face.
Yes, and I think I probably lurched against Renelle and while we were waiting for the sausage rolls to come out of the oven or something. And I remember she said, can you hold my drink while I go to the washroom? Well, you wouldn't do that today, would you? You know, somebody you've never met.
With a ladder tattooed on his face.
Exactly. So we, I mean, yes, exactly. So we talked for 3 hours, and she said eventually when I asked for the fifth time, yes, okay, here's my number. And she said, but do not call it because I live with my mom and she's elderly and please do not wake her up. So I went home and I called her and woke up her mom. And my mom heard me chatting up the mom of Ronell and her on the phone. And she came up, what are you doing? What are you doing? And I said, well, here, talk to this girl. I think she's a good one. You tell me if you like it. So I handed the phone to my mom and they talked for 10 minutes. I think she's lovely. And apparently Ronell had just said to her mom, well, this is the guy I'm going to marry. She didn't tell me that, but we've been married a lot of years now.
And your mom eventually passed away. Tell me the story of how the care for her after she died came to you.
My mom, she got lung cancer and then she had chemo and we thought that she'd beat it because she was given the all clear and she had her life back and she was in such great spirits. And then it spread to her brain. So my sister Wendy came out from Canada to help take care of her. And my sister belongs to a religious group called Adi Dham. Their spiritual leader is a fellow named Adi Da, and he's a guru. He's written dozens and dozens of books on the afterlife and how to live your life and blah, blah, blah. A very charismatic guy. But, you know, I wasn't into the practice, but my sister was. And as part of it, what they say is that when a person dies, you take care of the body yourself at home. So you prepare the body for burial yourself, and you have a vigil for 3 days. And she had done this for quite a few people overseas, friends of family, people in her group. So she was very good at the process. She knew it well. She knew how to do it. So she came over and she asked me, can we do this for mom? It's very important to me. And I was like, oh, God, okay. So we'll have to keep her in the Mossman home if she dies.
Right, a vigil in the home.
Yeah.
After death.
Yeah.
For 3 days.
For 3 days. And so I said, well, if you run it, yeah, okay. You know, I'm going to respect your beliefs. And she said, great. And, you know, if anything happens, I've got the manual. And she handed me this sort of little booklet, which is like the Adi Dham guide to do it yourself, body preparation. And I was like, oh, okay. And so I put that down. I wasn't going to need that. And then Wendy's daughter, Shanna, I was in a little car accident in Canada and my sister said, I got to go back and be with my daughter. And I said, that's okay. You know, I've got my brother and John and we'll look after mom till you get back. So the day after Wendy leaves, my mom goes into a real downturn, has to be rushed to hospital and she passed away the next morning. Well, my sister's barely got off the plane in Canada and mom's body is still at the hospital. And I'm left holding the mum and the booklet. It's called Easy Death. So I open it up and there it is in step form, what I've got to do.
Your mum died in hospital?
My mum died in hospital. So, that made it hard.
So how did you get her?
Well,
how would you do that? How would you get her back to your house?
I didn't know. I literally had this conversation with the head of the hospital who said they weren't going to give me the body. They weren't going to release it. They said, I know that you have to if I ask you, because it said that in the book. He said, well, how are you going to transport the body? So I looked in the book. And I said, with a refrigerated body taxi. He said, do you have one? And I said, do you have a Yellow Pages? He laughed. Walked out of the room and I found with my sister's help on long distance call through the Yellow Pages, a body taxi. And he reluctantly said, I'm reluctantly signing these papers to give over the body to you, but I'm washing my hands of it, whatever happens now.
So what happened then? This refrigerated taxi comes.
They were booked for like 3 hours later. And so I rushed home to my brother, Glenn and John Knutson. And I said, we got to do it. It's just the three of us, right? We've got the booklet. My brother's like, great. It's just like IKEA, you know?
It's not. What were you thinking and feeling?
I was really conflicted because I was like, I was the one arguing with the doctor to get the body and I wasn't even sure I wanted the body. then when we got home and the body was coming, so I said, look, we just got to do it. We, you know, we'll take turns doing different things. What's step two? Like, look in the book, quick. Step two was, you know, buy supplies. We'd go down to Bunnings or somewhere. I think it was a local hardware. And we had to get rubber gloves and cotton balls and packing tape and 30 ice bricks. Because we had to lay her on ice for the 3 days and keep changing the bricks and putting them back under to keep her cold. I remember when I went to the clerk, I said, here's what we need, you know, gloves, cotton balls, packing tape, and bricks. And he said, having a party, are you? And my brother said, no, we've got to keep our dead mum cold. He said, do you want a bag? I said, she comes in one. So we went back, and then step three was get the room cold. It's got to be 3 degrees or less. And so we were like, what do we do? So I went off to Cash Converters, and I said, I need the biggest portable cooling unit you've got, you know. And he sold me this enormous machine, which we got in the car and took it home. And then we essentially we had to have a little powwow and say, okay, now is the tricky part. We've got to prepare the body. Who wants to lead? I said, well, you know, my brother goes, should we do rock, paper, scissors? I said, no, I'll do the first one. And so we, you know, we had to do all the things you have to do, you know, wash the body. We had to, there's things that you have to do. You have to, you know, plug the orifices, all those things you have to do. And
you had to do all that?
Yeah, I had to do all that.
What state were you in while you were doing that?
I think had I had to do it alone, I don't know. I would have been just too freaked out. But because my brother was there and because John Knutson, who's very, you know, he's a compartmentalized kind of guy. He's very matter-of-fact accountant. And he said, okay, what steps next? All right. Okay. So, and he kind of went into that mode. And my brother was like, this will be fun. Come on. We're doing it for mom. I was like, okay, well, they're in. I'm in. I remember the first thing is you have to wash the body. We decided to take a limb each, and we're washing mum's body. And I hadn't touched her, obviously, since she died. And that's a really weird thing when you touch the body first and it's cold. And so we're washing, and I noticed this big scar she's got where she fell and had to have a shoulder replacement. And I'd never really seen it because she always hid it. And so I was touching the scar, and it was kind of serene, kind of, you know, surreal moment while I kind of washed the scar. And then I thought, oh, what's going to happen to the actual ball joint when she's cremated? Like, weird sort of questions go through your mind, and you go, oh, well, just stick with the task at hand. And so we did that, and we got her cleaned, and we got her propped up so the blood wouldn't pool in her head. It would pool in her feet.
A lot of people hearing this story will be kind of freaking out at the thought of you preparing your mother like that. But of course, this is something people always did for their family members when they died, and they did it for centuries and centuries. Yeah. It's only a recent thing that we don't do this anymore. Does it help you become more resigned to the loss of your mum?
I think so. I think the first night when we'd finished and we had to dress her in her favorite dress and lay her on the bricks and all that, and we sort of went, great, cup of tea, job well done, and we went into another room. No one really wanted to go back in. So we were in the kitchen, and then I thought, no, I've got to go in. I've got to sort of make myself go in and have little conversations with her. That was my thought. And it was very strange. And then the next day, we had some people over. Some of her friends came over and sat with her. And it was, older people found that quite nice. Went in and sit with June, talked to her about old times and blah, blah, blah. And that sort of relaxed me. And suddenly I found I was enjoying, whenever I'd walk down the hall, just popping in, tell her something I forgot to tell her, or, you know, own up on something I should have told her years ago or whatever. And it became the process that was really taking layers of dread away. And we had a nice sort of vigil with flowers and songs and stuff. When they finally came to take her away, I was almost reluctant for them to take the body. In fact, I walked around the block so I wouldn't see it leaving the house. But then I thought about it after, and I thought, there's no more. I've said it all. I've done it all. I've touched her. I know she's gone. I know she's dead. But I also feel like if there's another place where her soul does go, I've helped that happen. I feel really good about it. And I said to John Knutson, I said, you know, if someone else close died, I'd do it again.
Was your dad still alive when your mum passed away?
No, he had died a couple of years earlier. And it was a shame that they didn't
have some time together, because in his very short two sentence will, all it said was, "All good things come to an end. Don't forget, I loved you all very much, and that includes your mother, Chuck."
He left you that fish. Did he leave you anything else? Did he have any money to speak
of?
Yes,
he did. I'll grab it because it's the sound effect will help. He left me two things. He left me this, which you can sort of hear. That's his pony guide badge, number 31, 1948. And he left me this, his Viagra. He said, "Johnny, look, Charles Knowles, right on the label. No one will ever know. I go from a gelding back to a stallion in half an hour."
The mystery of your father. It's been amazing speaking with you, John, and I thank you so much for taking us through the life of you and your mum and your dad. What an extraordinary story. I hope you write a book about it one day.
I think I better.
Thank you so much, John.
Thank you.
Came in last night at 10:30. That baby of mine wouldn't let me in. So move it on over.
Move it on over.
Move it on over.
Move it on over.
Move over, little dog, cause the big dog's moving in. She's changed the lock on our front door. And my door keyed on.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.